he goes down, revs up the chainsaw, rawr, rawr, and all the neighbors come out, and it's a big block party.
The inner Alaskan comes out as the snow in Washington, D.C. comes down. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 9th of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a new theory on why the herring in Prince William Sound haven't come back.
We're not saying that the humpback whales caused the problem initially. We think that they may be limiting the recovery.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Snow has shut down the federal government in Washington, D.C. It snarled roads, broken tree limbs, and caused many D.C. area schools to cancel classes for the entire week. But Alaska's congressional offices are still open in the nation's capital. APRN's Libby Casey reports from a snowed-in Washington.
Washingtonians are calling it the snowpocalypse, Snowmageddon, Snow-MG, and now, as the city braces for another dump, Snowverkill. But Alaska Senator Mark Begich says he isn't calling the piles of powder anything fancy.
It looks like it's another snowfall in Alaska to me, so I don't have any name. It seems like nothing gets done around here, it seems, when the snow starts flying. People ask me, what do you compare this to? And I say, you know, it's like a spring snow in Alaska when it just comes and dumps on you so quickly that you have to adjust very quickly. But around here, adjusting quickly is not on the list. It's a slow process.
Begich was working in his Senate office Tuesday, where his staff had the doors flung open and the Alaska flag out in the hall. They kept their appointments, as did Senator Lisa Murkowski. Both senators are impressed with the dedication and ingenuity of the Alaskans visiting the nation's capital. They've managed to make meetings while locals have been stymied by the weather. Murkowski says a group from the Cordova Electric Co-op pinballed their way to D.C. despite airport closures and railroad cancellations.
They had gone Cordova, Yakutat, Juneau, Seattle to Atlanta, Atlanta, Richmond, and then got a car in Richmond and drove up so that they could have a meeting with me this morning. And then I said, well, you know, how are you going to get out of here? And they're like, well, we think we're just going to drive south and can find an airport where they can get out. But as they said, well, this is just kind of an adventure for us. You know, in Alaska, you know, you're not going to let weather stop you.
Murkowski lives within walking distance of the Capitol and says it's been a refreshing trip to work.
My staff gave me a hard time when I came in yesterday because, you know, I got my hat on and my backpack on my back and nice coat. And he just like, nobody would ever guess you're a senator, but you know, that's the way it is.
It's harder for those who live outside the District of Columbia, like Congressman Don Young. Press Secretary Meredith Kenny says he's stuck at home in Virginia.
His road is not plowed at all, and so he's been trying to dig out, but he has not been able to drive. And so we're actually trying to get him on a flight up to Alaska because we're afraid that his flight on Thursday might get canceled. So we're trying to get him out of here and get him up to the state, where they know how to handle snow a little bit better than they do here.
But even if the congressman isn't at his desk, Kenny says his office is open, ready for business, and greeting Alaskans as usual.
It's a really busy time of year, and we've got tons of visitors coming in, you know, every day, and it'd be a real shame if they came all this way and we'd have to cancel their meetings. So we're trying to uphold our obligation to them as best we can.
The snow has given the delegation a taste of real winter. Murkowski says she spent Saturday, the biggest snow day so far, stuck indoors doing taxes and her financial disclosure forms. But that freed her up to enjoy Sunday, which was like a March spring day in Fairbanks. Dazzling sunlight reflecting off the snow, everyone out on the streets shaking off cabin fever, and the city covered in quiet white. Murkowski says her husband got to flex his Alaska muscles when a tree weighted down with snow fell across a local road.
So he says, so I'm going down with my chainsaw. So he goes down, revs up the chainsaw, rawr, rawr, and all the neighbors come out, and it's a big block party as he bucks up the tree and chops it into fireplace-sized pieces for everybody. So he felt like the real Alaskan man out there with his chainsaw, and it was a good Sunday morning for him.
Senator Begich and his 7-year-old son Jacob stopped by the deserted Capitol over the weekend carrying their winter tools.
It was a sight to see a young boy and his dad walking through the Capitol. It was so quiet, all the security guards looked at us with on our shoulders. I had a big snow shovel, and he had the broom over his shoulder. I'm sure a lot of the guards, they figured out, oh, those guys from Alaska.
Begich says his son has reveled in the snow days and playing outside, but the senator says he doesn't actually have a pair of winter boots for himself.
You know, the one thing about D.C., they do put a lot of salt down, and so within a day or so, you could already start seeing the bottom of the road in some areas. So you just, with no cars on the road, you could literally walk down the street because no one's driving. I have tennis shoes. They were good enough.
Maybe feeling comfortable in sneakers in the snowpocalypse blizzard is the ultimate sign of an Alaskan in D.C. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
By this time next year, charter halibut operators in Alaska will have to carry a permit in order to take clients fishing. The application period for the permits started last week and runs through April 5th. Although permits won't be issued until late summer, some people who qualify are already planning to sell theirs. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Olivia Olson owns Petersburg Fisherman's Services, a broker specializing in buying and selling commercial fishing permits. While much is unknown about how the charter permit system will work, Olson says she's already been contacted by interested buyers and sellers.
Yeah, officially I don't have any listed yet, but I've talked to 2 or 3 buyers and I've talked to 2 or 3 sellers. And so it looks like we're getting ready to put it out there and see what they will bring.
Speculation right now is that permits could go anywhere from $25,000 to $175,000, depending on whether they're for southeast or south central Alaska and the number of rods an operator is allowed to use. Olson says most of the sellers she's talked to say they'll hold on to their permits for a couple of years rather than take something on the low end. That could mean fewer permits available immediately.
I think that we'll see a few out there and everybody sitting back to watch and see what happens with the first few.
But David Franz with Alaskan Boat Brokers in Juneau says he's talked to a lot of charter operators who are ready to sell right away. Franz, who does both boat and permit sales, says there could be a glut of permits on the market as soon as they become available.
There's a lot of guys that are just saying, you know what, I'm going to retire. I'm not going to charter fish anymore, and I'm going to sell my boat and go do something else.
Franz says that would likely lead to consolidation in the charter industry as larger operators buy up permits from the smaller boats. But he says that's not necessarily a bad thing. Many small operators run charters part-time as a way to supplement their income. Franz says consolidation could end up making it more of a business.
If you are going to be a charter operator in Alaska, I think you're going to end up having to be, you know, more of a professional than just a guy who, you know, wants to try to help make his boat payments.
Olson agrees there will eventually be consolidation, which could make it difficult for new people to enter the charter industry. She thinks some of the first buyers will be lodges that also offer guided fishing trips.
Most of the lodges have been running more boats, and now they're not going to be able to run as many boats as they have been. So if they can pick up enough permits to bring in the clients that they need to keep their operation running, they're going to be some of the first people picking up permits.
The permits are designed to slow the growth of the charter industry, which has expanded in recent years to the point that Southeast Alaska anglers have exceeded their guideline harvest level by more than 40%. Operators in both Southeast and South Central will be required to carry the new permits starting February 1, 2011. In order to qualify for a permit that can be bought and sold, operators must have made at least 15 fishing trips during 2004 or 2005 and the same number in 2008. Non-transferable permits will be available for charters that made fewer than 15 but more than 5 trips during the qualifying years. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, warm weather leads to strange queues in Southeast.
The big trigger for flowering is day length. So after a certain number of hours of daylight occur, the plant can flower.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A legislative dispute is already developing this year over the amount of spending that will appear in the capital projects budget now in the House and Senate Finance Committees. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak, says Governor Parnell has told members that they should limit the amount of money spent on their projects to $100 million this year. That has been about the average amount spent in recent years when state revenue is tight, but Stevens says the Senate does not intend to honor that limit. He says while members respect the governor and some of the administration's large capital needs, Parnell is not recognizing last year's budget that set aside money for savings and didn't include any legislative projects.
The understanding and probably the promise in a way was that this year there would be capital projects. And so as you talk to senators and representatives, I'm sure you've heard that they all have a lot of projects at home that were not done in their communities that need to be done, good projects that really affect people, affect them in all of our communities. So there's a difference of opinion as to what that dollar amount should be.
Stevens says the Alaskans were affected by last year's action, and most members this year would like to see four or five times the amount the governor wants. Governor Parnell says he anticipates dialogue over the exact amounts of the budget, but he wants restraint in spending while saving still more for the future. He says his projects total $300 million, and he's set aside room for a $400 million total, but to say those numbers are fixed isn't accurate.
Overall spending is the issue here, and for me, if I'm looking at an overall general fund budget in that $300 to $400 million range, and we're looking at a finance package for buildings, that's what I'm looking at. And that what that does is it leaves surplus in savings for the future. So that's, you know, it's all on the table for discussion in that way.
Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, co-chair of the Finance Committee, says there's plenty of money for communities. He says there's room to work in as the state anticipates a $700 million surplus this current fiscal year and another $300 million for next year. Anchorage Democrat Johnny Ellis says the public sees the economy as getting soft and legislative spending is needed where it counts.
You could look at a capital budget this year, an early capital budget, as a jobs package, a jobs bill, that, if I had my way, would include a lot of deferred maintenance. I think we can come together with the governor on that in a good way. But the governor, you know, if he's talking about a $400 million capital budget and him deciding agency requests for about $300 million of that, I think it would behoove us to go through those agency projects and decide which agency projects can be afforded and then which community projects would be better job generators.
Ellis says that putting three-quarters of the budget toward agency capital requests and only $100 million to local needs is out of balance. Some Southeast lawmakers want to create a $1 billion endowment to pay for road, airport, and ferry improvements. They say it's the best way for Alaska to replace declining federal transportation funding. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Representative Peggy Wilson wants to create what she's calling a second permanent fund. She's trying to persuade her fellow lawmakers to pass and voters to approve a constitutional amendment creating the Alaska Transportation Infrastructure Fund. Wilson and her House Transportation Committee colleagues are proposing three measures to create and fund the $1 billion endowment. The Wrangell Republican says it would help replace the federal money that's paid for the majority of Alaska's transportation needs.
The money that's going to come forward from here on out is going to be not very favorable for states with low populations. And so because we get 89% of our funding from the feds, we have got to start a long-range plan and figure out how we're going to take care of our state's needs.
Wilson estimates the endowment earnings would provide about $65 million a year to start. 60% would go to roads, 13% to aviation, and 12% to ferries. The rest would be split among harbors, public transit, trails, and bike paths. State gas taxes and vehicle registration fees would beef up the endowment. Three measures would need to pass to create the fund.
First, a joint resolution that would go to a vote to allow another permanent fund to be developed so that the people would need to change the Constitution to allow a dedicated transportation fund. And then the second bill would be to create the fund and define how it will be managed and how it will be used. And then the third bill is to appropriate $1 billion for seed money.
The Alaska Transportation Priorities Project says it's smart to put money aside for roads and ferries. But the group's Lois Epstein says Wilson's approach focuses on new projects without repairing aging infrastructure.
It doesn't require the state to make really tough decisions about whether we should be focusing on big mega projects like the Juneau Road project, the Gravina Bridge project, which is still being looked at by the state. Those are very expensive projects that the state has to make some decisions because of the declining federal funds.
The legislation would establish an 8-member council to decide what projects would be funded. Four would be legislators, the Transportation Department commissioner, and three regional directors would fill the other seats. Epstein calls that approach cumbersome.
It doesn't make sense for the bill to have very specific allocations for the different types of transportation, 60% for roads, 13% for aviation, 12% for the Alaska Marine Highway. She's doing this on top of having an advisory committee, and it seems to me that that is so inflexible at the point where you want to be able to make some flexible decisions on priorities.
The plan, similar to one proposed by former Governor Sarah Palin, first goes to Wilson's committee. She admits creating the fund will be difficult, given competing needs. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Governor Sean Parnell today formally sent the legislature a bill listing changes he wants to make to the state's oil tax regime. The bill puts details on the proposals he made January 14th that he said would increase industry investment in the state. He says the bill would be a good step to offer more incentives that would spur on more oil development.
My choice on behalf of Alaskans is to increase jobs and increase oil production. And that's what my tax credits and tax benefit proposals do. It only allows credits and benefits if companies drill here, develop here, put jobs here in Alaska. And, you know, I got a phone call from one of the producers 2 hours after I made the proposal, and they said that'll produce jobs, that'll produce new oil.
There has been debate and legislative hearings already on changes to the ACES tax structure now in place. And Sitka Republican Bert Stedman says that overview will accelerate.
We're going to start taking a detailed look at ACES on the component parts of that and its strengths and weaknesses. And it'll take several days to go through that. Also, we're going to take a look at what happens to our tax collections when we have a gas line and what impact it may or may not have on that. Some of us are a little concerned that it may have a negative impact to the point where we have no gas revenue at all.
The bills will be formally read into the House and Senate records tomorrow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist awards. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Pacific herring declined dramatically in Prince William Sound after the Exxon Valdez ran aground there in 1989, although studies have not conclusively linked the herring population crash to the oil spill. Now, new research indicates that humpback whales are moving into Prince William Sound as year-round boarders, and that the whales may be foraging on herring. The study was conducted by Jan Straley, a marine mammal biologist with the University of Alaska Southeast Sitka campus, and John Moran, a NOAA fisheries biologist with the Auk Bay Research Center in Juneau. They say the humpbacks may be preventing the herring population from rebounding.
We're not saying that the humpback whales caused the problem initially. We think that they may be limiting the recovery so that the herring got knocked down for some reason. And there's lots of theories out there, disease, a lack of food, oceanographic conditions. But whatever got them down to their low levels, at the same time they were knocked down, humpback whale populations have increased in the North Pacific.
Yes, in 2004 to 2006, there was a basin-wide North Pacific study that over 300 researchers. All that data collecting told us that there were, about 20,000 humpbacks in the North Pacific.
Does this mean that the humpbacks themselves are rebounding? Weren't they at one time thought to be in decline?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were hit hard by whaling. And there are some estimates, I'm not sure how accurate they are, but I think in the late 60s, 1,000 to 2,000 humpbacks left in the North Pacific. And so now we're up to 18,000 to 20,000 in a fairly short period of time.
Well, the humpbacks have always traveled the Sound. However, your research indicates that they're staying there. They're lingering around. They're not just summer tourists. So what leads you to believe that?
Well, we got some anecdotal information from fishermen and other people that had been working in the Sound saying that they were seeing humpback whales associated with these herring schools in the winter. So the herring going to these overwintering aggregations, and the humpback whales were seen with them at places like Sawmill Bay, I think, in Port Gravina. So there's anecdotal information. There were humpback whales feeding on herring in Prince William Sound. And that clued us in that there might be something more going on. And so we spent, I think, the winters of 2007, 2008, and 2008 and 2009 cruising around the Sound looking for humpback whales.
Do they feed on, say, the spawning herring, or is it an all-year-long kind of consumption?
Well, for our study, we were looking at overwintering herring, but they do feed on spawning herring, and they'll feed on herring all year round. But there seems to be this influx of whales into Prince William Sound in the fall, and they're sticking around, some of them into March.
Is this cause for joy or cause for alarm? Obviously, it's a good thing for the whales. Is it a good thing for other species, though, that there's fewer herring?
I think overall the system is accommodating for the increase in humpbacks. And the herring are, I think the time will tell what the impact actually is in terms of the amount of predation upon the herring stock or biomass. It may not be a good thing if you're a commercial fisherman and you think you're going to have a herring fishery in the next few years. That it may or may not happen depending on how well these whales or the herring are rebounding. It seems like at a certain level they can withstand a certain level of predation. And I think that's a question that we don't know exactly at what point were the herring and whales be able to coexist, or were the herring down so low that predation is going to suppress that recovery. And that's a question I think that's still unanswered, or there's lots of unanswered questions, but that's one of them that's out there.
Jan Straley and John Moran are fisheries researchers following humpback whales. While fierce winter weather continues to make headlines across the country, parts of southeast Alaska are experiencing far above normal temperatures for this time of year. In fact, with blossoming salmonberry bushes, blooming bulbs, and the first bear visit of the year, Sitka is enjoying a false spring. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has more.
Something that was popular in the 70s was biorhythms. When all of your biorhythms lined up, you had an extraordinarily good or an extraordinarily bad week in your life.
That's Rick Fritsch, and no, he is not a meditation guru or lifestyle coach. Fritsch monitors climate and climate change issues for the Juneau Office of the National Weather Service, and this next comment is proof.
And when the ENSO or the El Nino conditions are in effect, the positive Pacific North American conditions tend to get exaggerated or amplified. It would appear that from just looking at things in a qualitative sense, that's exactly what's happening.
See what I mean?
Actually, Fritsch went to great pains to help me understand that 50 degrees and sunshine in Sitka in January is not necessarily a catastrophic unraveling of wintertime. Rather, it's a fairly understandable alignment of three global recurring weather patterns. Here they are, from longest to shortest. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is the cycle of sea surface temperatures, which occurs on a 30-year period. The more familiar El Niño cycles every 1 to 5 years and produces warmer-than-normal air temperatures over the ocean and all that nasty stuff affecting the rest of the country from California eastward. And finally, there is the Pacific North American Oscillation, which occurs about every week and is used by weather forecasters to predict warmer-than-normal temperatures and precipitation. Like a rare alignment of planets, these three huge weather cycles are all happening at the same time and all contributing to the warmer temperatures and low precipitation that we associate with spring. And while it's fun to stroll around without a coat in Alaska in February, false spring does have a downside.
Frost will damage flowers at various stages. So if something's a little bud, it won't be damaged very much by the frost. But as the flower matures and gets ready to bloom, killing frost will destroy the flower, and then you won't have fruits, which are nice salmon berries and huckleberries and blueberries.
Mary Stensvold is the regional botanist for the Forest Service. Late in January, hikers on Green Lake Road began to notice blossoms on the salmonberry bushes. Not just buds, but blossoms, in January. For that to have occurred, according to Stensvold, it takes really nice weather.
The big trigger for flowering is day length. So that, in combination with environmental issues such as temperature, say, okay, it's fine to flower. And so they're going to start trying to flower.
Mary Stensvold is reassuring to people counting on a good berry crop this summer. It's not false spring that hurts berry making as much as a late winter.
Salmon berries, for example, bloom over quite a long time. So there'll be early flowers, middle flowers, late flowers. So all isn't lost.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Yukon Quest race leaders are at the Eagle Checkpoint, about 400 miles into the 1,000-mile trail. Hans Gott was first in around 12:30 today, followed closely by Zach Steer, Hugh Neff, and Lance Mackey. The four mushers arrived at Eagle within a 20-minute time span. Sonny Lindner followed 4 hours later. The next checkpoint after Eagle is Dawson City, the first scheduled stop for the mushers across the border in Canada. It's a 150-mile run from Eagle. And that's it for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.